Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. So happy to be back here on a Monday. Got through Father's Day weekend all right. I think got through it all right. It's kind of nice to have a weekend where you're the featured member of the family. That's a pretty good deal to be the featured member of the family. It's always good to be back here on a Monday. Maybe it's Tuesday morning where you are. Whatever is the case, we're glad you're here. Thanks for being with us. And so we got two really good hours. And both of them will feature Joe Heschmeyer, who's in town, apologist and author and speaker. Joe Heschmeyer is out here with us for a week. So when Joe's here, we just put him to work. He doesn't get his feet barely touch the ground. We just keep getting him back into something else to record or produce or whatever with us. Joe, thanks for coming back for this Monday.
My pleasure.
We're going to do open forum with you. All right.
Let's do it.
People can ask whatever they want.
Let's do it.
888-318-7884. You know, I'm not going to go through this whole hour without talking about how you treated me on Friday. 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. Open forum means open to anybody. If you're not a Catholic, but maybe you got a moral question, or maybe you have got a question about the Catholic Church, something you'd like to know, something that bugs you, maybe something that intrigues you, whatever, you're very welcome to call. 888-318-7884. Catholics can call, non-Catholics can call, and you can call about whatever you like. 888-318-7884. I gave a talk on the person of Jesus on Friday, and Chris Check was supposed to introduce me. Didn't bother to show up. He didn't even bother to show up.
Wasn't even in the state.
No, he had to do his presidenting somewhere.
He was and in so he deputized, Steubenville, I think, taking his son for college stuff.
Oh, I thought he was off doing president of Catholic Answers type stuff. No, he was taking Nathaniel.
Unlikely story, right.
Oh, well, Nathaniel's an awful good guy. I'm glad he's going to. They're lucky to be getting him at Franciscan University in Steubenville. You know Nathaniel, do you?
I do.
He's valedictorian of his class.
Yes, he is.
Cathedral
sharp
Catholic
as
High School.
Tack. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so I had to give a talk on Jesus. And
I was asked to MC it, but no one gave me any information about you.
How do they not know you're the one guy not to ask to MC it when I'm giving the talk? Because we do this on Friday nights. Catholic Answers gives a free talk in San Diego. Once a month, one Friday, and Father Tazi over at St. Therese of Carmel Parish is so good to let us use that beautiful hall they have over there, and he always comes, mm-hmm. And then you emceed. And can I tell how, did you hear about his introduction, Darren? Because he said, this is Joe introducing me. He tells a story about Evelyn Waugh. You know Evelyn Waugh, who, the first thing you have to say when you say Evelyn Waugh is, he's a man.
Yes.
Like everybody's like, wait,
not Evelyn.
Wait, are you using the wrong pronouns? No, that's apparently some kind of British thing where you can have men named Evelyn.
Well, a fun side digression.
Yeah.
A lot of girls' names used to be boys' names.
A lot of girls' names used to be boys' names. Like, give me an example.
Like Evelyn, like Hillary.
Oh, that's
like,
right,
you know,
Hillary.
Like, if you think about like early
right.
20th century Catholic authors, they have what we now regard as
Hillary Vellick and Evelyn Waugh.
Yeah, exactly.
Both dudes. Okay, yeah, I didn't think about that.
And Bobby McGee was originally a girl in the song. So like almost any boy's name you can think of.
Wait a second. How did Bobby McGee
get it? No, I'm just thinking, like, think about like the masculinist, the manliest like male names, like Frank and Bob, and we're already starting to see variations for girls. And it doesn't really go the other direction. So a lot of Stevie Nicks would be another example of like taking an obvious boy's name and like modifying it so it can become a girl's name. A lot of girls' names, if you look at the origins.
Do you agree with Bobby McGee that freedom is just another word
for nothing left to lose? No, that's of all the definitions of freedom I've heard, that is arguably the worst.
There is a kind of freedom that comes with nothing left to lose.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of a Franciscan freedom.
Yeah, but I like the way you... it sounds much more nihilistic in the song, but I like the way you take it as the freedom of poverty.
I think that's why some saints choose poverty, is because to be free to live the gospel every day, however the Lord calls them that day.
And in all seriousness, in that sense, there is something to that, not just for poverty, but also even for celibacy. Jesus talks about celibacy as living like the angels. There's a sort of eschatological anticipation, like you're looking forward to the life to come when you embrace the celibate state.
Yeah.
So there's something really beautiful and really rich about that. I'm not sure if that was what Bobby McGee meant, though. But yeah.
No, I think that Bobby McGee had other things in mind. But okay, so here's how, Darren, I wanted to tell you this. And then we'll get on with the show. Are we doing a show today? Yeah, we are. Open forum.
If we can squeeze any colors.
Okay, but this was the worst introduction I've ever received in my life. The single worst introduction than ever. Joe said, he tells this story about Yves Lemoyne that many people have heard about the very beautiful Catholic novelist wrote the book. Helena wrote, what's the most famous one? It just went out of my head.
Brideshead Revisited.
Brideshead Revisited. Which is, they've never made a good movie out of Brideshead Revisited yet.
But the BBC series is like 11 hours long.
Is it good?
Oh, yeah. They ran out of money to adapt it, so they just played it straight.
I like it. I like it. Okay, so Yves Lemoyne, notoriously also grumpy person. Yves Lemoyne actually had some, people don't like to mention this part, but he actually had some quite serious mental health challenges. But so he's a very grumpy man. And so he goes out to dinner and he's grumpy with the wait staff the entire time. He's a jerk to them the entire time. And at the end, the waitress says to him, she says, "You're so rude. You're a rude man. And you, a Catholic." And he says to her, "Imagine what I would be like if I wasn't a Catholic." And Joe says, "This is a perfect description of Cy." That's how he starts. That's his introduction at me.
The audience loved it. The centrality of the Lord to your life. What was wrong with that? It was divine grace. You know, without Jesus, you can do nothing.
And then it got worse because Joe said, I was instructed to give a biography of Cy, but he didn't bother to look up anything about me. So he just made it up. And in his biography of me, my mother was an aspiring actress. My father was a carnival barker. What other things were in there?
I don't know. You had a falling out with a gentleman by the name of Whitey Bulger.
Oh, yeah, Whitey Bulger and I had a falling out.
I'm trying to figure out how you came from Boston to San Diego, and this was a plausible. More than one person asked if that
And then later,
true.
You didn't know this. Later, I told you my story about that I might have met Whitey Bulger one time.
So it turned out in just randomly reaching, I found
that
out
I kinda
better.
Did.
Yes, I found out better information about you than if I just read your bio on our website.
All right. That was the meanest introduction ever. But
really
the audience talk. Really liked it.
Yes.
They really liked it. The number is 888-318-7884. Peter in Oregon, you are going to start us off. I said Oregon, right? Mm-hmm. I didn't say Oregon. Oregon. Because I got instructed by Archbishop Sample, who apparently thinks he's some kind of, I got to do what he says. He's not here, right? He said I have to say Oregon. Peter in Oregon, watching on YouTube, you are numero uno today, Peter. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hey, thanks for having me on. And hey, I love the show with the Archbishop Sample, and he definitely gave you some good advice there. And sorry about the Celtics.
Thank you very much for all of that. It wasn't advice, though. That was clearly direction. And the Celtics and I are not getting along right now. We're having a problem getting along.
Well, my question is around degrees of reverence for sacred images, in particular digital ones. Like, are all digital sacred images considered equal in reverence? For example, for some reason, I feel okay having pictures of Mary as the background for my phone, but not of the Eucharist.
Oh,
yeah,
how interesting.
I absolutely get that. I have the same kind of gut sense as you. That's a great question. I have not seen any good direct answer to that, because I think in some ways it's just too new of an issue, you know, until very, very recently, people didn't have phones that they were putting images in the background of. But yeah, even like on Facebook and other social media, where you see like images of the Eucharistic Lord, it's hard to know how to respond. I think the first thing I'd say is an image is that. It's an image. And so in that sense, whether it's a painting or a photograph or a live stream, it's different than seeing the person themselves. So I would default to what the Second Council of Nicaea says back in the 8th century. And we have to adapt this for the modern context. They're dealing with things like paintings and icons. And they lay down this, that people are drawn to honor these images with the offering of incense and lights, as was piously established by ancient custom. Indeed, the honor paid to an image traverses it, reaching the model. And he who venerates the image venerates the person represented in that image. So they would say the image isn't the saint. The image isn't Christ. But rather is like a doorway. And you are not giving any kind of honor to the painting itself. I mean, you could imagine, like, if you're an art critic, you could just say, oh, wow, I don't know who this painting is of, but it's so beautiful. But when you're doing religious devotion, you're not really doing that. You are instead, as if through the window of the painting, honoring the saint or honoring Christ. So in that sense, it does seem appropriate that even while we recognize a picture of the Eucharist isn't the Eucharist, nevertheless, it's a window to the Eucharist. And so I try to give the kind of reverence. You know, I'm not going to superficially treat an image of the Eucharist for that reason. So I don't know. Again, like, I don't have a clearer bit of advice from the church, but the last time the church gave very clear advice on this back in the 8th century, that advice was to treat the thing with the respect that you would treat the one that the thing represents.
What do you think, Peter?
I think that's great. Can I ask a quick follow-up?
Yes, please do.
What about digital images compared to maybe printed ones or a statue? Would we treat them any differently? Because, for instance, I know for maybe a sacred statue or a picture, you would need to maybe burn it or treat it a certain way to dispose it. Any type of insights around that? Mostly just out of curiosity.
Yeah, that's a really good question. In terms of especially like blessed objects, blessed images, there we have a strong resistance to treating sacred things in a way that's profane, meaning like worldly or vulgar, ordinary. And so we want to treat religious depictions in a respectful way. That doesn't mean that, like, if you've got an image of the Eucharist on your phone, you have to, like, burn your phone before you can change your background. But it does mean that you should approach it with reverence. And in some ways, I think this is just uncharted territory, because the typical way is a physical object that's been blessed is handled is you either burn it or you bury it or you bequeath it to somebody else, just to keep the B alliteration going. You can, you know, give it away. But with something like a digital file, none of those are options. Like, none of those apply. And so just like with something like intellectual property, it's going to be very different when you copy a song somebody has than if you steal their piano. Likewise, the concepts of treating a thing with dignity that's been blessed or that's sacred in origin are going to be very different when we're talking about the digital realm than the physical realm.
You know what, Peter? I'm going to leave it there because I just realized we are right up on it for the break. So we'll take a quick break. All the lines are full. Looking forward to lots of questions. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. It's Open Forum. More of that right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
I don't like looking back. I prefer to look forward and keep moving forward. There's plenty to cover. I do a lot of research and try to dig out the bits and pieces of a life or of an agenda that people don't want to talk about.
The World Over with Raymond Arroyo, Thursday night, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. Both hours, and both hours open forum. There's Nathaniel Check. Nathaniel, did you and your dad go to Steubenville? Did you go to, is that where your dad was, taking you to see your college? All right. And you are still valedictorian of your class. They're not taking that away. You're still valedictorian? Yeah.
Okay. Meanwhile, the listeners are like, what are you talking about over the break, if this is what you talk about on the air?
Well, actually, over the break, we were talking about, Darren had a really good question, because there's this thing called an NFT, which is a...
Non-fungible token.
Yeah, non-fungible token. That's what I was going to say.
I think this is a sore subject to people who've been investing in those recently. They have not been doing great.
Well, could you get a non-fungible token blessed?
And then could you sell it?
And then if it was blessed, could you sell it?
Then Edgar asked, can you bless digital things? And I said, finger rosaries.
Yes, you did, Joe. You did say that. And you, for some reason, you were proud of it. Joseph in St. Louis, Missouri, listening on Catholic.com. We're glad you're here, Joseph. Go ahead with your question for Joe. No? Joseph? I hear some activity, but we're going to come back to you, Joseph. Right now, I believe the name is West, out here in California, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM, satellite radio. West, are you there with us?
Yeah, how are you doing today?
Very well, thank you. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Yeah, my question is about the Eucharist, and I'm curious why in, for instance, some of the Episcopal churches, they're still doing their communion service with, or their Eucharist with, the bread and the wine. And at Mass, in a couple of different churches I've attended Mass over the past several months, there is no wine, there is no blood, per se, and we're doing the bread, and we're doing the beautiful Eucharist, and I love Mass, and I love the liturgy, and I love the whole thing, but I'm just curious why we're not partaking in the wine or the blood in Catholic Mass.
Yeah, that's a great question, and one that's been kind of a hot topic for about 500 years. Really, actually even 600 years, because Jan Hus raised the same objection back in the 15th century. There's two dimensions to it. So yesterday was the Feast of Corpus Christi. And in some churches, before the gospel, there is a sequence, is what it's called, which is like a hymn, basically, that's sung called the Lauda Sion. It's written by St. Thomas Aquinas, written for this feast, which is just a proclamation of the church's belief about the Eucharist. And one of the things that is proclaimed in there is that even though Christ comes to us under the appearance of the bread and wine, that whether you receive one or both, you receive the entire Lord, that we don't sever him, we don't rend him, we don't break him. So he says, caro cibus, flesh from bread and blood from wine, yet in Christ in either sign all entire confess to be, that all of Christ is present in the smallest particle of the host. All of Christ is present in the smallest drop from the chalice. And that's because Christ isn't separate flesh and blood like he was on the cross, that he is the risen, glorified Christ that we're receiving. So in that sense, you don't have to receive both in order to receive Christ, just like you don't have to have a lot of Eucharist to receive Christ. You can have the smallest or the largest quantity, and you're still receiving all of Christ. It's the exact same. But then the second half of that question is more of a pastoral or prudential judgment of like, well, should we still commune the faithful with the chalice? Because the priest receives under both species every time. The celebrant has to. The faithful don't have to. The pros are it's the way Jesus did it at the Last Supper. He gave everybody both the chalice as well as the bread that had become his body. The cons are that it's more time-consuming, there's more risk of profanation in the sense of people spilling, and in the old days, wine was much more expensive and tasted very bad in Northern Europe, and so there were some really pragmatic considerations that led to the withholding of the chalice. So there aren't great arguments, in my view, that are just overwhelming in either direction. You're not theologically required to do one way or the other. In many parishes, they'll offer the chalice, and people may come up or they may not come up. So it's just one of those things where I think, honestly, it's as much a logistical issue as anything else. If you've got one priest communing the entire congregation, that's a lot harder to do for administering both species. Does that make sense?
Well,
Interestingly
enough, when I converted from the Episcopal Church, obviously I had to go through some of the sacraments, and the communion was one of them. And at that one, I was given the chalice.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it felt very familiar coming from the Episcopal Church, where you pretty much do it Sunday in, Sunday out. But I'm much more happy at home here in the Catholic Church. I've asked, and I get different answers from everybody, so this was interesting.
Oh, good. Well, hopefully. I mean, and you can find, I mean, depending on what diocese you're in, you can usually find parishes that do it both ways.
West, I'm going to leave it there. Joseph in St. Louis, apparently the line is solid again. So Joseph in St. Louis, Missouri, watching on Catholic.com. You are up next. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Well, thank you guys for taking my call. I really appreciate it. Love your guys' show.
Thank you.
So here, I'll get straight to my question. So in 1 Samuel, you know, it says that God gave into David's hands or Saul's hands the Philistines or the Amorites or the Amalekites, whoever. Basic God, it says God gave into David's hands the Philistines or whoever. And my question is what does that mean? Does that mean that God gave David and his army super strength to defeat the Philistines? Does it mean that God made the Philistines stupid and they just were weak all of a sudden? Or what does that mean exactly?
I see. Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, on the most basic level, to say that God delivered the Philistines or whoever into David's hands and Saul's hands just means that God gave victory in the battle. But I think your question is more the mechanism of, well, how did he bring about that victory? And the easiest answer to that is it doesn't say. It doesn't say here's exactly the way the battle went. We were just told the outcome of the battle. So I'm thinking of like 1 Samuel 23, but there are other examples of this. Where all we hear is that, you know, we won, they lost, without any of the details of that. And there are any number of ways. So I wrote an article for Catholic Answers Magazine several issues back now that looks at this when it talks about the angel of the Lord defeating the enemies of Israel with Sennacherib. And it's really cool because even though, as here, the biblical account is a little sparse, it doesn't tell us what it means. We have in that case parallel accounts because Sennacherib's invasion of Israel was like really well documented by Assyrian sources, by Babylonian sources, by Egyptian ones. And all of those accounts differ, but they agree in the main. So it's pretty clear even from the Assyrian account that they were winning and then suddenly they turned back and went back home. And they don't tell us why, obviously. There's some indication from the Egyptian accounts that this might have been an outbreak of mice that ate the bowstrings of the archers. So they suddenly woke up and didn't have weapons anymore. And that is one way the angel of the Lord can be visited upon the enemies of Israel. The biblical account doesn't tell us that, and we wouldn't have known that. We would only know that, like, God brought about a victory, and, you know, the Assyrians went home with the tails between their legs after seeming to be in, you know, a sure victory. And with the Philistines, we're not even given that much information. We don't have these parallel sources to say, well, what was the means by which God brought about a victory? But that gives us one concrete example of what that might look like. There's a natural disaster, there's an outbreak of disease, there's plague, or there's infestation, or there's any of these other things that keep the free will of everyone intact, and yet God still works out the victory in a very clear way.
Joseph, I will leave it there. Thanks very, very much. The lines continue full. It's open forum here on Catholic Answers Live. We go now up to Oregon. Casey in Oregon, watching on YouTube. Casey, you there with us?
Hello.
Hi, Casey. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Okay, so I usually talk with Protestants, and sometimes they point out that they ask, like, why are a lot of the canonized saints white or, like, European? And they say that, and they sometimes point at this and say, see, Catholicism is a quote-unquote white religion because they favor the canonization of white saints and how the church isn't racially diverse in their saint selection and is white ruled in that area. Is this true, and how do we respond to those who attack Catholicism this way?
Casey, that's a great question. Let me unpack that a few different ways. It's Juneteenth, so it seems appropriate to talk about all these things. I'd say, first of all, there's way more diversity among canonized saints than there is among, say, Protestant reformers, which are, you know, all European. Or, you know, so, like, it's a weird
or
objection.
Or in a Catholic church. You walk into most Catholic churches, it's just a pretty diverse place.
Yeah. One time I compared a very, like, proud of itself for being diverse and inclusive parish with literally just pulling up the Archdiocese of Washington, which is where I was living at the time, and looked at the first 10 seminarians that they had listed. And there was way more diversity. And so the church is much more Catholic, much more universal than almost any Protestant denomination. I think it was G.K. Chesterton who talked about the absurdity of imagining a Southern Baptist Mongolian. It just doesn't make sense. I mean, most Protestant denominations are, you know, local. they, in many cases, were explicitly ethnic or racial. You know, the Southern Baptists break away from the Northern Baptists because they want to keep slaves. So you often have these much more ethnocentric and racialized understandings of Christianity. Now, Catholicism was not spared that entirely. You will definitely find plenty of racism in the church's history. You'll also just find, I think, as a natural kind of consequence, that the evangelization of Europe happened first. So as you go back, you'll find a lot of European saints before you get, you know, missionaries to the New World because they didn't know the New World existed yet. So I'd say for all of those reasons, yeah, you'll find a lot of white saints.
Can we continue this on the other side?
Yeah, let's continue that on the other side.
I actually would like to add one thing, if I may. May I?
You may.
Oh, good. We'll be right back. More Catholic Answers Live.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com. Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Tomorrow on Mortal Life, the life you were meant to live.
We'll look at how the theology of the body can help you live a more abundant life.
That's tomorrow on Mortal Life, 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 Central on EWTN Radio.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest, and he has given me permission to say something, so this is going to be very exciting. But Casey is on with us, calling from Oregon, asking about a challenge made to him about why Catholic saints they seem to be so white. Why so many Catholic saints are white? Does that mean that the Catholic Church prefers white people to other people? Do I have that correct, Casey? Is Casey?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Sorry to wake you up.
You're mean. You're a mean person.
I am a mean person. But Joe was given a bit of an answer, but I would like to add something that I think where many often Catholics are shy about talking about, and I don't think that we should be talking about it. After the death and resurrection of Jesus, the gospel went out in every direction, including Africa and Asia, not just to Europe. The reason that we think of the church as European is because of what happened in the 6th, 7th, and 8th century, no, 7th and 8th centuries, and 9th century, because Islam came across North Africa and Asia and cut Christianity in half. So many people, for example, today think the gospel didn't do very well in Asia. The gospel did very well in Asia. I mean, with Chaldean Catholics, Assyrian Catholics, Syro-Malabar Catholics, Nestorian Catholics, all the way to China and Mongolia. Genghis Khan's mother was a Christian. And so the gospel did very, very well. Christianity was cut in half by Islam in the 7th, 8th, and 9th century. So, excuse me, I keep saying that wrong. It's really the Yeah, 7th, 8th, and 9th century, right. Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, and the church did not get to be fully international again until Europeans invented ships that could go around Islam. It's as basic as that. Until the Europeans invented the technology to get around Islam, the church was trapped. And so I don't think it's true that most of the saints are white or that there's even a predominance of white saints. I think if we want to talk about diversity, there's probably more Catholic buildings named after women and minorities than any other institution in the world, certainly more than any government in the world. So that gives you a sense of the diversity of the Catholic Church. But I didn't want to just neglect to mention Islam because it's an important part of the story.
Yeah, that's true. When you think about the historic hubs of Christianity in the very early days, you've got Jerusalem, Antioch, which is now in Syria, Alexandria, which is in Egypt, Rome, which is in Italy. And then eventually you've got Constantinople, which is in Turkey. That is not overwhelmingly white.
Not
I mean,
at all.
No, it's very tricky, like how you define whiteness and are Turks white, and, you know, all of those kind of silly questions. But when people say this is so white, blah, 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 they typically mean after, as you said, after Europe gets kind of trapped in and is surrounded suddenly on, you know, its southern and eastern flanks by Muslims who aren't receptive to the spread of the gospel, to put it mildly, then yeah, it turns out they evangelized north. They evangelized the pagans in Germany and in Scandinavia, all of which wouldn't have been viewed as the same race at the time, by the way. Like, the whole notion of whiteness and race is in so many ways a 19th century invention. So a lot of that is a little bit anachronistic. And when there is this reconnection that you kind of talk about, Cy, even in the 15th century, you see, like at the Council of Florence, for instance, you have delegations from the East and from the Coptic world who are coming to Florence to try to reunite the church. And the Christians there are like really wowed and overjoyed at seeing people they've never seen before. It isn't like, you know, it's easy to imagine something like the antebellum South, where there are white people and black people living side by side in open racial hostility. And this is more like you could go your entire life without seeing someone who doesn't look like you. And so there's a really fascinating example of this in what's called the Magi Chapel from the 15th century. There's an adoration of the Magi painting by Benozzo Gozzoli, it's one of the earliest depictions in Renaissance paintings of a black person who is one of the Magi, because he just is like, oh, cool, this is what they look like. I'm going to include them in my painting. There's none of this, like, you don't see the kind of color-based racism that'll come later. And it points to the fact that this was not seemingly the mindset of Europeans. I'm sure a lot of people had crazy beliefs about what their neighbors and the neighbors beyond them looked like, believed, and so on. That's every culture has that. But you don't have like racism as we'll later come to understand it in the same way.
Casey, what do you think of our twin answers?
Yeah, that cleared up a lot of stuff for me. I guess what I would ask is it true that is there a dominance in like amount of saints? Is there numerically more white saints than, let's say, saints that are black, Asian, etc.?
Probably.
Probably. Certainly more than you'd find in the New World. Like, if you were to compare it to like North and South American indigenous, because that evangelization happens so late.
Yeah.
I imagine that's going to be the case.
First in Europe?
Yeah, I mean, because evangelization in Europe happens almost immediately after Pentecost in the first century. We don't have people coming to the New World until the 15th century at least, because they don't know the New World is there. So you couldn't have a bunch of, say, Mohawk saints because no one knew the Mohawks were around.
Right.
I mean, they weren't at the time, but you know what I mean. Like, you wouldn't find Amerindian saints.
But everywhere the church goes, she makes saints so that you have people like Kateri Tekakwitha or the, you know, that.
Right.
Like, she doesn't like go, I'm sorry, you don't qualify as a saint. You're not white.
I mean, yeah, there's nothing,
you
know, like that.
Like, you think of the Filipino saints who were made saints because they were evangelizing Japan, for example.
Yeah, we just had, not like a couple weeks ago, St. Charles Lwanga and the Ugandan martyrs.
Right.
I mean, you definitely have I would say the best predictor of the number of saints is how long the place has had a strong Catholic culture. Because until you have a lot of people in that nationality who are practicing believing Catholics, you, by definition, aren't going to have a lot of canonized saints.
Okay.
I see. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I think I really appreciate the call on Juneteenth because I know, Joe, we've spoken about this before. We're both big fans of the Juneteenth holiday. I'm very glad that we have a Juneteenth holiday. Although, Juneteenth was yesterday, but we still get the holiday today, yes. Right? But I didn't know if that was going to happen with Juneteenth. We'll still recognize it always on the 19th, even if it's on mm-hmm. a Saturday or Sunday, right? But then the day off will just move.
Yeah, which is I'm a big fan because
in any holidays I have two priorities. One, priority one, what are we celebrating? And Juneteenth makes me really happy. And two, am I getting a day off for this? So yes. Like I'm less enthusiastic about
Columbus
Day. I like
the order
now.
You put that in. I don't think anyone believes you that's the order of your concern.
That's the order. That's the order. That is very much the order. But by the way, many of our listeners are not here in the United States, and we try to be sensitive to that. And we're Americans, so we end up talking about American stuff. So I shouldn't just assume that people know what this is, but a celebration of, essentially, it's a celebration of the emancipation of the American slaves.
It was specifically originally in Texas.
Yeah, because, and it's just that the news of emancipation came really late to the state of Texas, to certain parts of the state of Texas. And so this is a celebration of when the news of emancipation arrived in Texas. It's not a celebration of the day of the Emancipation Proclamation.
Well, yeah, it's complicated. The Emancipation Proclamation only freed slaves in Confederate territory. It didn't free slaves in Union territory.
Yeah.
So there's a lot. I mean, there's a lot that goes into that. But yeah, June 19th, 1865, General Order 3. Right. Texas is emancipated. And I think we actually have a call about that on line 3, by the way,
We can go to the phone. But, I mean, all right, let me see who we got. Let me just find out who's on line 3. That would be Carol in Bridgewater, Massachusetts, listening to EWTN on channel 130, Sirius XM, satellite radio. Carol, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi. So I heard your comments that you just said about being happy about Juneteenth. And so I'm just trying to filter it and come to an understanding of it. And something that I do believe is that I think just having coming off the cusp of a lot of Black Lives Matter issues, which, a lot of the things that what Black Lives Matter stands for, I don't agree with, promoting the violence and the things that they've done, to have a holiday that now I think divides more than unites. Obviously, getting rid of slavery was incredible. And so one question I have is, why couldn't we just make Emancipation Day a bigger thing? Why did we have to, in the year, from what I researched, 2015 might have been one of the first celebrations of Juneteenth. Now that word. Now, I know that Juneteenth is a celebration of the anniversary of what you just said, what happened in Texas, I think it was 1863, when finally the people in Texas heard what had happened of the signing on January 1st. So they were a little bit late, in getting the news, and that's a great thing. But I think that the news is that slaves are free, which came from the emancipation. Or maybe, I don't know, your other guest said that only had to do with the Confederate state, not the Union states. That might have something to do with it. But,
well,
again, I just don't...
Go ahead. Yes.
I just don't think the church is, like I said, we need holidays that are uniting. We need to celebrate every race, I feel, because there's a lot of division. And I think that that's what, I mean, all of a sudden from, like I said, I have not heard the word before this year. Okay, it was around, great. But to make it a federal holiday, there's only, 10 states in the country that are jumping on to making this a holiday where the states are going to give the day off. I mean, it's kind of like, it's something new that all of a sudden, here you go, there it is, accept it, and that's the end. And I think that if you're going to do something like that, make it for something that unites all the cultures, all the races.
I got you, Carol, but I don't know. Could I just get a clarification from you? Because the thing that seems divisive to you about it is that it's associated with the Black Lives Matter protests?
No, I think it's just that I want to begin hearing about, you know, I see signs, you know, Black Lives Matter. I see the LGBTH flag, and I think it divides this country. I think we need to start promoting things that unite, because obviously those are hot topics, you know, and people either stand one way or the other. And I think that we need to unite.
I agree with you. I don't disagree with you at all. I also kind of agree with the thing you said about celebrating all races. I mean, I think I don't understand how we don't have a holiday for Native Americans. And then people say, well, it should be Columbus Day. Well, why don't we let Native American people pick a day that's important to them? Because it seems to me that Juneteenth is a day that's important to African Americans. They picked it. It's their day. It's the day that they celebrated. So now the country gets in on that celebration. But I like holidays actually haven't always united. Labor Day was not a uniting holiday.
Well, Martin Luther King Day was very divisive when it was first proposed.
Yeah, I suppose, right. Mostly in Arizona.
Even something like President's Day, where to celebrate Abraham Lincoln in many parts of the country was controversial.
Right.
So it'd be hard to find certainly a national holiday.
But I am struggling a little bit, Carol, with what exactly is the I guess the reason that I think Juneteenth is good is that it doesn't seem divisive to me. I don't feel like it's a Black Lives Matter thing.
I don't think there's
a
strong anti
It just seems like a great thing to celebrate.
It is a great thing to celebrate, and I agree. But I think attention needs to be put to areas that we can call ourselves, bring us all under, like, humankind. You know, I'm sure there are things that we can be more united with, but also not just that, how much I agree or if they could change it a little bit. It's more that, as you said, President's Day was divisive. Martin Luther King Day was divisive. Let's not bring it to church.
Well, okay, so I think I see.
People understand it better, you know, and until, or, you know what I'm saying? And especially because at church, I'm hearing about Juneteenth, but I hear absolutely nothing about politicians who are being allowed to go to communion and how that really shouldn't be allowed, or how, hey guys, hey folks, you know, we're going to be voting, you know, this coming up week. Please remember, not naming any politician at all, please remember your duty as a Catholic to not vote for pro-choice candidates. I don't hear that. They don't want to step on those toes, but they're okay with things that are just up and coming. These, you know what I'm saying? It's like
I do. I do, Carol, but I can't say that I share that impression about Juneteenth.
Well,
but
I, mean, we
I could be
Juneteenth
missing
celebrations when I was growing up, but partly it's regional. I mean, I grew up in kind of an African American area in Kansas City. If you're up in New England, where Juneteenth may not have been as deeply rooted, it probably does seem newer. The first Juneteenth celebration was in 1866, so it's not new in that sense. It was a Texas holiday from 1938. So it's in the South and kind of moving north. Juneteenth has been a big celebration, and one of the ways it's been described is America's Second Independence Day. And the idea being that the promises made back in 1776 and in 1789 were now true for Black people as well as for white people. And so in that sense, it does seem very much like what you're wanting, everyone just being treated the same. Well, Juneteenth is the celebration of that actually becoming truer.
But if I may say, like, so President Joe Biden, he makes this, I don't know if it was an act of Congress or what, but I have to say, you know, this is obviously political pandering, and what there's always that when you make a new holiday. At a certain point, you just kind of got to go, I don't care about that. I mean, sure, the politicians are just trying to make their political points, and they have their venal reasons to do what they do. But is what they did good or bad? That's what I end up with. And I think it's good for two reasons. One, we needed a holiday in June. And I'm dead serious about that. I think holidays are good. And two, if you're going to have one, Juneteenth is a great day.
Yeah.
I don't know, Carol, I'm not trying to talk over you, though. Like, I wanted to
speak to one half of the question we haven't even gotten to yet, which is what about the church's role? Because even if we can say this is a good thing for the state to have as a holiday, but what should the church be doing? And I think that, as she said, a lot of people don't understand Juneteenth or think about it in terms of these like Black Lives Matter kind of terms, in terms of modern race-based politics. And it's better for the church to really say, no, this is a Catholic issue. This is a Christian issue. And here I'd point to paragraph 2414 of the Catechism. I'm just going to read it. The seventh commandment forbids acts or enterprises that for any reason, selfish or ideological, commercial or totalitarian, lead to the enslavement of human beings, to their being bought, sold, and exchanged like merchandise in disregard for their personal dignity. It is a sin against the dignity of persons and their fundamental rights to reduce them by violence to their productive value or to a source of profit. St. Paul directed a Christian master to treat his Christian slave no longer as a slave, but more than a slave, as a beloved brother, both in the flesh and in the Lord. And the reference there is to the Epistle of Philemon, that he's writing on behalf of Philemon to argue for his emancipation, to argue for his freedom. And so just like all Christians should be united against the horrible abuse against the unborn, all Christians, even though it's like, oh, it's a political issue, all Christians should be united against racial enslavement, any kind of enslavement. And we are hidebound if we take St. Paul seriously and if we take the Catechism seriously to have that position. So in that sense, like emancipation, whatever you may think about the ins and outs, the particulars of the Civil War and the way it was fought and et cetera, emancipation was an undeniable, undoubted good that there aren't two possible Christian positions on. So in that sense, Juneteenth is celebrating something that was an untarnished good that I think all of us should proclaim from the pulpit and from the pew and be something we rejoice in.
All right, Carol, I'm going to give you the last word because my concern is that I might be missing something that you're saying because it does seem to me that this seems more divisive to you than it feels to me, and I might be missing some. Go ahead, Carol.
But I just, like I said, I know that there have been other cultures that have suffered in this country, the Irish and the Italians when they came over, the Jews, and that's all is that I would like us to unite under one holiday, all of us. The freedom, as you say, you know, that belongs to every human being, freedom and dignity of life, that I just wish that we could, you know, maybe the next holiday will be something like that. And because it definitely is, emancipation is definitely something that we need to celebrate. And I agree. I would like to see something, maybe the next holiday, something that unites all of us. And that's what I would love to see. But I will take that, you know, like I said, and I agree with the last few things you've said, I'll open my eyes and take it to Jesus and seeing it for what it is. Hopefully it won't divide us more, and maybe the next holiday will include everybody.
Boy, you are a lovely caller, Carol. Thanks very much. I really appreciate that call. And the opportunity to talk about Juneteenth. I did want to do that today, and I'm glad we got the opportunity. Anyone's welcome to call because it's open forum, 888-318-7884. I never did the break? What? Do I have to do the break now? Okay, we'll be right back.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
St. Hildegard of Bingen was a mystic, an abbess, a botanist, a saint, and a doctor of the church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
Hildegard had her first visions at the age of three, which she called the shade of the living light. She later wrote about them in works declared by St. Bernard of Clairvaux to be from God. Pope Benedict XVI agreed when he named her only one of four Doctors of the Church who are women. in 2012.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. It's open forum. The number 888-318-7884. Because of the time, Joe, I think I'm just going to go right back to the phones and we'll let you talk to some folks. All right, let's go to Robert in Missouri, listening on the Covenant Radio Network. Glad to have you, Robert. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Thank you. So good to hear you. I haven't called for 2 months, it seems. Anyway, to get to the question, the church in scripture, New Testament, is described as Christ's body and also his bride. Now, how does that relate to the marriage of the Lamb and his bride, which is described in the book of Revelations as the New Jerusalem? Was one written before or after, or how do they relate, sir?
That's a great question. I like how succinctly you put that question, too.
Thank you, Robert.
Yeah. Those are all different ways of describing the same hard-to-describe reality. And so even if you look at Ephesians 5, Jesus is going to say the church is the bride of Christ, and then he says the church is the body of Christ. Now, neither of those metaphors exhausts the truth, or he wouldn't have the other one. And yet they're hard to kind of square. How could it be both his body and his bride? Well, New Jerusalem, we can add to that list of getting to the truth, but in this way that's, if you take all the metaphors very literally, it's hard to kind of square. So St. Paul explains this a little bit in Romans 11 with yet another image, this time of a wild olive shoot. And he describes Israel as a wild olive shoot, and some of the unbelieving branches were broken off, and then some foreign branches were grafted in, these foreign branches being the Gentile believers. And so what you have is not the replacement of Israel. You know, when we talk about the New Jerusalem, we don't mean God got rid of the Jews as his chosen people, God got rid of Jerusalem. No, no, we don't mean that. We mean that there's a reorganization of the people of God, that he draws together the faithful, whether Jew or Gentile, and he brings the Gentiles into what he's already begun with the Jews. And that's what he means by the church. It's the ecclesia, the assembly, the gathering together. And that reorganization is also what's meant by calling the church the New Jerusalem. And the danger of even saying New Jerusalem is it sounds like we mean a totally second, like separate Jerusalem. It's just the reorganized Jerusalem. It's the people of God rearranged to include faithful Gentiles and with the non-believers kind of having broken off from it. Does that make sense? Does that harmonize those images for you?
Yeah, that's great. And I thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. What a very pleasant call. Well, we're having lots of nice calls today.
Yeah. I think we could do the call on line 5 quickly if you want to, just because I feel bad because there's such a short time in between breaks.
Okay.
That it feels bad to only take one call and then have more commercials.
Okay, so let's go to line 5, and that is Dylan in California. Go ahead, Dylan, with your question.
Hi. So I have this ongoing search I've been on for a long time now, and that's finding like the right Catholic Bible to really put my mind and like my prayer life into. Mm-hmm. And I've really distilled it down to either the Revised Standard Version Catholic Edition or the New American Bible Revised Edition. So,
you want Joe to settle it?
A lot of fun. Sure. Yeah.
Joe, settle it.
Yeah, actually, my friend and colleague, Trent Horn, has a really good clip called Cringy Notes in the Catholic New American Bible. And long story short, the New American Bible was created. The New Testament was overseen by one Cardinal McCarrick of Ignamy, now Mr. McCarrick. And it was supposed to be the latest and greatest critical scholarship and a liturgical Bible and a Bible ordinary people could use. And if you understand anything about Bible translation and footnotes, those should have been 3 different Bibles. It was a bad project from the beginning. But the footnotes in the NAB are bad and in some cases heretical. So I'd point you to Trent's thing, Cringy Notes in the Catholic New American Bible, and say positively that the RSV CE, the Revised Standard Version Catholic Edition, is a beautiful Bible, very well rendered, and I use it as my personal go-to translation.
All right. Thanks very much for that. I appreciate how quickly you got to the question, Joe. I appreciate how quickly you did the answer. And now we will take a very brief break, and we'll be right back with more Open Forum. There's three lines open, so perfect time to call, 888-318-7884. You want to talk about Juneteenth? You want to talk about sacraments, Jesus, Catholic Church? Whether you're Catholic or not, you're welcome to call, 888-318-7884.